So, for argument's sake, if you could use your example, if the RF is at 455 kilohertz and the BFO is at 454 kilohertz or 456 kilohertz, you get the sum and the difference, but you can't hear the sum because the sum is 800, 900 kilohertz, you're going to get the difference of 1 kilohertz. That's how you get what you 1 kilohertz note. 456 kilohertz BFO minus the IF frequency 455, you got 1 KC note. Or if you got 454 kilohertz mixed with the IF of 455, again, 1 kilohertz note, one, you get the difference. You're not going to hear the sum because the sum is, what, 900 kilohertz. It's way out of the passband. In a modern receiver, they call it, it's still there. They call it something else. They call it a carrier oscillator. They don't call it a BFO anymore, but it's the same thing. You go from upper to lower sideband. There's usually two crystals in the radio that are set at the factory, and you switch either the sum or the difference to get upper or lower sideband. That's one thing I was going to bring up. And what is an oscillator? Well, basically, an oscillator is an amplifier stage that feeds back the output to the input. It goes into oscillation. And the person who looked that up, the person who developed the oscillator was Edward R. Armstrong. In fact, the Armstrong Tower is still in New Jersey because they ran early television off. Armstrong was probably one of the most prolific engineers of the day. Before there was an oscillator, they had to use a spark because they couldn't generate RF any other way. Armstrong came up with the oscillator, which allowed them to do CW, which meant continuous wave as opposed to spark. Don't get up on the internet. Back to that,
N2EL. Yeah, quite nice, Dick. When it comes to the beat frequency oscillator, almost every radio has the beat frequency oscillator, and the older radios that had it, in one of the final stages of the radio, just before the audio circuits begin, and as you tune the knob on the beat frequency oscillator, you'll hear the tone go through zero beat. It goes... In other words, the tone goes down towards zero and then back up the other side as you're continuously rotating the knob from left to right. As Rich was explaining to you, when the oscillator is below 455 KC, you'll hear a tone. When it's above 455 KC, you'll hear a tone. When it's exactly at 455 KC, the tone goes to zero hertz. One of the things that's kind of amazing is the beat frequency oscillator could be anywhere in the radio. It could be at the final stage, or could we be back in the front end? Let me give you an example of that. A few of us have done an experiment where you take an external oscillating circuit that radiates a weak signal. It was called a grid-dip oscillator. A grid-dip oscillator is a small oscillating circuit with an external coil on it in this handheld device. You hold this external coil near a circuit that you want to know its resonant frequency, and you turn the dial on the grid dip oscillator. It really is a variable frequency oscillator, and when you tune through the frequency that happens to be the exact same frequency of the resonance of your external circuit, you've got an inductor and a capacitor across each other sitting on the table, and they have a resonant frequency, and you hold your grid dip meter near it, and when you hit that resonant frequency, the inductor and capacitor on the table suck out some of the energy. The meter on the front panel of your grid dip meter goes into a dip, and it tells you, aha, that's the frequency of resonance. Okay. A number of us have done the experiment of where Morse code reception is taking place in your radio. Your radio is in the AM mode, not in the Morse code mode of operation. It's an ordinary AM radio, and the signal is coming in. Let's assume now the signal is coming in at 1.1 megacycle, because you were listening to Wind 1010 New York. 1010 kilohertz happens to be what that's on. You adjust your grid dip oscillator at that exact frequency, a little bit higher, a little bit lower, holding it near the radio antenna, and you'll hear that tone again. In other words, you'll be converting the carrier when the announcer is not speaking. You'll convert that carrier into a tone, by just simply tuning an oscillator nearby. The radio is now hearing two signals at once, the real broadcast as well as your grid dip oscillator nearby, and the two get mixed together and give you this tone. So you could say the beat frequency oscillator if you wanted to.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The beat frequency oscillator could be on the earliest stages of the radio. For a bunch of reasons, they don't do that, but it could be. Or the beat frequency oscillator could be on the outside of the radio and still give you that desired response, if you know what I mean. Back to you for any further comments on this one, John. And DeBrunx is giving us some questions tonight, KC2WGB. And do you have another question that you'll be giving us at a later time, John? K2RIW and the TechNet.
Oh, I'm sure something will come up, Dick, but I just wanted to get that in to see if we could satisfy him because it's getting a little late. And perfect job, and I'm sure he's happy. Maybe he'll email me something else. We'll see what happens. But thank you very much, and back to you, Dick.
The next guy on our list was Alpha Kilo 1 November Sierra. And when you convert that 1 into the letter I, that AK1NS becomes Atkins, and you go to AK1NS on the QIZ.com, and you'll see a beautiful picture of his shack and his antennas and whatever. So, Bill in Hicksville, got some good-looking equipment there, and that's a very crafty way of choosing your what would you call it now, vanity call. And lucky that was available to you. And you're allowed to ask any subject you want, Dave. AK1NS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Yeah, who says the FCC doesn't have a sense of humor? I have a question about a continuous tone interference on 28.320 that's been plaguing my QTH near the Limark meeting hall for months. And it's an extremely clear signal with no... hardly any S signal meter reading at all. It's a pure 620 hertz tone, magnitude of the background or floor noise, and I ruled out all nearby equipment. I went out and I did a little 3 a.m. bunny hunting the other night and found something. I don't know if it's related. I'm going to let it drop for a second. I'm 3,000 feet away from the Neptune Regional Transmission System subplant that terminates near the Wantagh Parkway in Westbury, 600 megawatt station. I've been hearing a noise with my ears for weeks and months. I went outside with a dB meter and a frequency generator, and I measured 50 dBs of background audible noise at 480 hertz. I Googled it, and it came up, and it turns out that it happens to be a nice harmonic of transformer hum, magneto-restricted materials vibrating. I don't know if it's related to the 28.320 problem, but I'm running out of ideas, and I'm looking for some input. But I will check the wall warts that Rich mentioned. Over to you.
They got some fancy words there, Dave. I guess... It's William D. Atkins, and I guess Dave is what you prefer to be called instead of William or Bill. It's your choice. In the case of high-power transformers, almost all iron follows something called the magnetostrictive effect. That really means that if you took a bar of steel and wrapped some wire around it, put some current through that wire so that you're creating a electronically created magnetic field. As you apply a magnetic field to iron, its length shrinks a little bit. That's called the magnetostrictive effect. So when the magnetic field is strong, the iron is a little bit shorter in length, and when the magnetic field is gone, it goes back to normal. Well, your 60-cycle power is making the iron cyclically change in length. But now the transformer itself is probably a three-phase transformer. It's got some very complicated winding techniques in there and methods of physical construction. Let me drop. And the sixth harmonic, correction, the eighth harmonic, 60 hertz is the general frequency that we run on power domestically in the United States. the eighth harmonic of 60 hertz is 480 hertz. So the transmitter, the transformer, if you were real close to it with acoustic equipment, I'm relatively sure you would find audio components at 60 hertz, 120 hertz, 180 hertz, and so on, for a bunch of physical reasons because of the method of construction of the transformer. Maybe at your range of measurement, the strongest signal happens to be 480, but I guarantee those other 60 cycle related components are probably present. And so, depending on the way the transformer is designed, how close they're coming to saturating the iron, and by the way, when iron becomes saturated, the waveform you get out of it, of the magnetic field, so to speak, when it drops, the magnetic field starts following a little bit closer to a square law, a square wave. A square wave is very rich in odd harmonics. Well, the sixth harmonic is an even harmonic, so that goes that theory down the drain. Oh, well. So it does sound like your 600 megawatt power station is radiating a lot of acoustic power. And I imagine there's also the possibility... I think you said Golf Zulu, I heard. We'll get to you in a minute. So, that could be what you're hearing. Now, you're also hearing, you said 28.320. That's not easily explained. Why a continuous tone at 28.320? And the continuous tone at 320 got stronger as you went closer to the power station, and the power station also has the acoustic noise at 480 hertz. They got a bit of a mystery there.
And it's more on upper side bend than lower in his area.
How about that? Okay, John, what's your theory on that one?
I had a short discussion with Dave about it, and I'm wondering if it's not the power company's control signals that he's hearing some harmonic of because they use low frequency. How it's getting to the 6 meter, I don't know, but it's possible because I tuned it in over here at my high gain antenna. I can hear it also, and only I hear it, it's worse on my low band, on the lower side band. And as I go down, maybe 3 kilohertz, it changes. I hear it from 28, 317 to 20. So, and he has the opposite. Very, very confusing. It's a mystery.
The question is why the needle of the meter doesn't move.
Most radios in the single sideband mode, when you start off with an extremely weak signal, you will hear that signal, the tone in the noise, because the human hearing system has a noise resolution bandwidth of approximately 50 hertz. So you could say the human hearing system has a 50 hertz bandwidth filter. The audio coming out of the radio might be 3 kilohertz wide, and you've got a 50 hertz filter that can scan across that. That's the filter that's between your ears. And therefore, if you take the ratio of those frequencies, convert it to decibels, you'll find out, I'm guessing that number is something like 15 dB. In other words, a signal could be 15 dB weaker than the noise coming out of your radio. Your hearing will say, I hear the tone, but the noise is still in total amount of noise power, total amount of signal power compared to the noise of the radio. It's got a negative signal to noise ratio, so that even if your S-meter had enough sensitivity, it's not going to move. So, and almost all radios, if you started off with an extremely weak signal generator, and as you start bringing the signal up from zero, so to speak, you're going to hear the tone coming out of the loudspeaker for quite a number of different amplitude settings before you finally start seeing the S-meter move. That's part of what could be taking place. Golf Zulu, I heard a little bit of a weak signal, and they ended with Golf Zulu. Give us your full call letters and your name, sir, and then your comment. K2LIW in the next TechNet.
Yes, not sure if it matters, not sure if I'm holding it, but WB2QGZ, Davidson. And I believe that Neptune's transmission line is high voltage DC converted to AC up in Hicksville.
Hey, Bill, that's the weakest signal I've ever heard from you. WB2QGZ, Bill from Massapequa. Very weak signal. So the high voltage DC converted to AC. Give us a few more words on that, Bill. Is that something taking place at the power station itself? Or where is the high voltage DC being converted to? I didn't know that we had DC power domestically down here. See, in places like Michigan and also in Canada, they do transmit megavolt level of transmission, power transmission. They do it with DC for a whole bunch of advantages. But somewhere along the line, the DC's got to be converted back to AC, 60 cycles, nice pure sine wave, in order for us to use it. I didn't know that that's taking place on the island. So give me a few more words on that one, Bill. WB2QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I'm in a crappy spot, so I'm not going to hold it too long. But I believe that Neptune line comes up from New Jersey as high voltage DC, and it's converted back to AC at that facility in Hicksville, which was built specifically for it. That's pretty much all I have. I have a one-page article on it from E-Science or something, but not a lot of detail.
Okay, so Bill's saying there's a one-page article in the EE Times about this Hicksville facility where the DC converts to AC. What's your guess, Bill, as to how long that facility doing that function has been in operation? You've got it, Bill.
Yeah, if I had to take a stab at it, I'd say around 3 years. I know that the bypass from way down at Jones Beach was torn up in the construction of the underground. And that's been, you know, a work in progress. But I guess about 3 years.
Interesting. So Bill is speculating that that has been in operation for 3 years. So in theory, that 28.340 signal maybe has been there for 3 years. Who wanted to give us another comment on this? Give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW.
AK1NS, that is correct. It's 3 years, and I just got on HF, but I only found it because there's a TechNet on Tuesday nights on 28.320, and I have it on. If you want me to turn it on real quick for you, you can hear it loud and clear.
Let's hear what it sounds like. Go right ahead, Dave.
Okay.
My goodness, that's a nice, pure tone. That particular radio you're using, take the main dial and tune it a little bit up and a little bit down. Let me hear that tone slightly change in frequency. There's something else I want to hear. Back to you, Dave.
Okay, I'll sweep the VFO a couple each way.
I do hear some other clicking sounds, is what I think Wesley is talking about. And by the way, when you sweep a beat frequency oscillator or any other kind of oscillator that's beating against the signal, you'll hear the tone change in a way that Dave just demonstrated right there. Dave, when you listen carefully, is it local ignition noise or something like that that's happening near your house that's making that extra sound we're hearing? Or do you believe that the power station itself is making those extra clicking sounds that we're hearing? Over to you, Dave.
No, it is coming from the same source. And if it's the power station, what got me thinking about it was, is that audible hum at 480, and I know it's a totally different thing, but the 620 is a harmonic, an auto harmonic of it. And like you said before, you know, the components of 60 cycle, 120, 240, my hearing's not that good, but that 480 is so audible, I can hear it in my bed at night from 3,000 feet away. And ever since, you know, this thing started up, I've been hearing people tell me about it from Massapequa to Staten Island.
Can I make a comment?
You got it, Wes.
Maybe wrong. Enter Aegean. For me, it sounds like the power company is sending the pulse. It's a clock that will control the power conversion from DC to AC.
I think so.
Well, the power companies are using various techniques these days, somewhat like broadband over power line. In other words, they do transmit down signals down those power lines, which are forming a telemetry function by way of measuring voltages at various portions across their grid, across a particular town or a county, and transmitting that signal back on the power line itself. You can do remote sensing of finding out is the full voltage getting down to the Massapequa area, if you know what I mean. So that's one of the things that could be taking place. There's lots of different explanations here. It does sound to me, Dave, like that signal probably has a number of microvolts per meter, milliwatts per square centimeter, whatever units you want to use. It sounds to me like it is probably exceeding FCC rules for electromagnetic interference. And as such, when properly reported, in theory, they should make a change to the design to stop it from doing that. So as long as you can now use a known antenna of known gain, and you drive around with your automobile and you measure certain amounts of S meter signal strength, then you come back to the shack with a good signal generator and find out how many microvolts into your particular receiver gives you that S meter signal deflection. Or you can do it backwards. You can calibrate the S meter in microvolts versus S9, S8, 20 over, and so on. Therefore, as you drive around, you'll know exactly how many microvolts you're receiving on, for instance, the whip antenna on your automobile. So by various means, at various distances, you can find out true absolute signal strength. You could then report it as a source of electromagnetic interference, and in theory, it's got to be corrected. So I think you've got that option, Dave. AK1NS.
Quick comment, Dick.
Yeah, stand by, Dave. Go ahead, John.
There is another device that the power companies use. I'm sure you've heard of demand meters. If you have, well, in New York, if you have over 7 horsepower, you must go to a demand meter. Now, a demand meter, that multiplier, which is another dial on the demand meter, has a window pulse sent that has a demand window to allow it to calculate. Now, maybe with the new meters, they're sending out these electronic signals where before they were just pulses right on the AC line. So that could be what that signal is.
Not on the ham radio frequency. It's a violation with the FCC rules.
Doesn't matter what it is. It's on the ham frequency. It's illegal.
If it was what you're speculating right now, John, individual demand meters at individual places where the power is being used, I wonder if John drives around his automobile and as he gets close to those, he'll see a stronger signal strength. So as you drive up and down the individual streets to the north, the south, and the east and the west of that power station and around your house and keep good recordings of the signal strength, you'll eventually figure out, is it more than one source of that signal because there are individual demand meters doing the emitting, or is all of it coming from the power station itself, the power substation, whatever it's called? So by you making a map of signal strength versus locations, you'll eventually figure out what's going on, and you could make this into a real nice science project and a real big report that you send to the authorities about this electromagnetic interference. Everything I'm hearing is leading me to believe it is beyond the specifications for how much interference signal is being emitted.
Great idea, Dick. I got another comment, if you can.
Yeah, go ahead with your other comment. Once he gets that map of signal strength versus location, he takes something like a Hagstrom map and puts a whole lot of crosshatch horizontal and vertical lines, and at each one of those intersections, he writes down the signal strength. He'll eventually be making the equivalent of a three-dimensional graph of signal strength versus location in Massapequa, and that's going to give you a lot of information. Over to you, John, for your comment.
Yeah, can you give out that frequency again, WS20?
Yeah, 28.317 to 320. 28.320 approximately is what they're reporting. Back to you, John.
Dickie had a great idea. What he could do is take his handy talkie or whatever device he's going to use, go up to any industrial type facility and find a meter. You'll notice it has a key in the glass. That's the demand reset. If he gets next to that meter and hears that, then he could try a couple of other locations, and that should prove the point.
Yeah, there's some very nice measurements that can be made on this one. Was there another person who wanted to make a comment? Give me your call letters and your name right now.
AK1NS for comment.
You got it, Dave.
You know, on the topic of repeating patterns in the chaos, I am using a spectrum analyzer at raster scope mode. And if I freeze it and play it back over and over again, we have looked at it closely, and it does sometimes look like it's some kind of a code or a repeating pattern. When initially we thought it was a revolving antenna, I'm not too far from Westbury Tracon, and that came to mind, and then of course Grumman, but I don't know if they have anything rotating around like that. But it does look almost like it's a signal of intelligent digital data going through it.
The repeating pattern when you see it, is it in bursts where the bursts are 12 seconds apart approximately? If so, since the ASR 7, ASR 8, air surface reconnaissance, whatever it's called, the FAA radar is running at roughly 2.8 gigahertz. Those antennas usually turn in the vicinity of one revolution for 12 seconds. So if you get a burst of this code once every 12 seconds, it would suggest that you're getting a mixture of the radar signal in there. So does it occur in bursts, and is there a time sequence like that that you've seen, John? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
John, yeah, I'm all right. Dick, there was no shift. There's no Doppler shift, so if it's a rotating antenna, there should be a slight Doppler shift. The waveform is steady, and I think Dave said the same thing on his spectrum analyzer. Back to you, Dick.
And I wanted to say exactly the same. I would have a problem with this statement that this is a radar.
Yeah, I should have turned it back to Dave. Dave, do you see the interference occurring in 12-second intervals? If not, it's not likely to be the radar. Over to you, Dave.
No, it's not in 12 seconds, and I do see interruptions in roughly 4-second intervals.
It does sound like a kind of data transmission, and maybe it is a demand meter. Okay. Are you enthusiastic enough to go driving around and measuring signal strength and putting those marks onto a map? Because I think you're going to see a pattern when you do that. Over to you, Dave. And by the way, we're going to give you multiple weeks to do this if you decide to do it. And please come back and let us know what you find. You got it, Dave.
I hear it on 28318 WS2N on CW.
Boy, if you're hearing it all the way out there and if it's coming from Hicksville, man, that is a potent signal. What Dave played us over the air, by my standards, is a potent signal. I think it's way above what it should be to be legal, if you know what I mean. You've got it, Dave.
We are teamed up and ready to go. So the first mission was to hear from the TechNet tonight. Thank you very, very much. I've got KD2AKX. He's got his van set up with an HF, and we've got antennas set up, and we'll get back to you next week with a report and see what we find. And like I said, we've already done the 3 a.m. Initial hunt, and that was pretty successful. So I think we're in the right path. We're going to go up there and take a look at Neptune. It's not far from here. Thanks again. AK1 November Sierra.
And so, Shane, with a question.
You got it, Wes.
And to exam. It was yesterday when I sent to John a short video, very short video, which shows a claim of spatial domain existence. John would have a better wording to describe this phenomenon. John, could you explain what is going on about the magnet in the water and the vortex? John?
Yeah, hold on, you guys. You're going into the next section of the TechNet, which I'm going to be giving an explanation of. When you said a question, I thought it was a question on the subject on the table, which was this power signal at 28320 that Dave brought to our attention. The next section of the TechNet is the space section by Paul, and then we're going to go into the more serious stuff. I'm going to give you a little bit of an explanation before we do that. Paul, WS2N, what's the latest in space? If you happen to have a report on that. Well, I think you had a question, one or the other. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Had a question, and really no space report. I just look up New Horizons, July, a couple of more years, and I thought it was 2013 and 2015 next. But yeah, I actually had a question, if you want to take that.
Go right ahead with your question, John. I questioned Paul. And Paul, your signal is just a tiny bit noisier tonight than normal, but don't worry about it. Just continue. Just thought I'd let you know about that. I hear a little bit of hiss in the background. You're not your normal hi-fi self. You got it, Paul.
Okay. Let me. All right, a little bit further west. I think I wasn't as far as I usually am on the beam. That's probably better. Okay, yeah, Dick, this is regarding CW. I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask the question before I hook this keyer up to an expensive rig, a relatively expensive rig. I want to hook an MFJ iambic keyer up to a Yaesu 450D. On that rig, you can come out with either one or two plugs. You know, one plug is just, but you could wire the plug one or two ways. You could either wire it for a straight key, so that's really nothing but an on-off switch, or you could wire it in a free-wire fashion, and you could hook it up to a paddle and use the internal keyer inside the rig. But what I'd like to do is use the existing, you know, I have a regular keyer here, MFJ keyer. I don't see why I can't take this thing and just wire it into those same two contacts that would normally be used for a straight key. I think it would work the same fashion. I don't think I'll blow anything up. Back to you, Dick. WS.
Okay, this external keyer that you want to use on your particular rig, Paul, I'm not quite sure what the question is. So run that by one more time. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, if you use the internal keyer in the Yaesu 450D, you need to hook up you would have three wires, you know, a dot, a dash, and a ground. Rather than do that, I'd like to use this, you know, external MFJ keyer, which is, you know, really an iambic setup. And you can take the, it's got two wires coming out of it. On the old rig, on the Kenwood 440, I just plug it into the keyer plug, and it's just two wires. It doesn't have an internal keyer, but the rig has an internal keyer. I'd rather not use the existing keying system. I'm used to what I got. But I wonder if I could do that instead of going out and getting this free wire plug or whatever it is. I could just use the same plug that I use a straight key for. Maybe I'm not making myself clear, but maybe that'll help. Back to you, Dick.
I know what he's doing, Dick. Absolutely no problem. We can do that.
Yeah, first of all, Paul, what's the model number of your rig? And then I'm going to turn it over to Rich, who is familiar with a lot of these, and he'll know what he can do. So what's the model number of the rig that you want to do this function with? Over to you, Paul.
Actually, not mine. It's my son-in-law's daughter's rig, the Yaesu 450D. It's a new rig. Yeah, that's right, 450, 450D. They had the 450, and then this is the newer one, the 450D that came out. So, yeah, I was hoping N2EO would be out there. I hope you didn't go. I was hoping Rich didn't go away. Back to you, Jeff.
Hey, Rich, you've got it. Tell him how he can take his Yaesu 450D and do that function. How does he have to change the programming and the knobs on the front panel and connectors on the back panel to do all that? N2EO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hey, Jacob, it's not that complicated. All you have to do is plug the key into the straight key input. The straight key, I'm not familiar with that particular radio, but they're all basically the same. The straight key input is made to use a bug or a straight key. You know, you close the key and the rig puts out RF. It's as simple as that. All you want to do is plug the key into that same jack. It shouldn't be a problem. Paul, what you want to do, though, is observe polarity. I don't know if your key has a read relay or a transistor output. The worst thing that can happen if you reverse the polarity from the key, the very worst thing that can happen is that the rig will put out a continuous CW note. You won't be able to control it with the key. You're really not going to damage anything. So, that's basically it. I would say the tip of the jack should go to the plus output of the Kia. The sleeve of the jack should go to the negative output of the Kia, and it should work fine. Back to that. And to the
It sounds to me if the final stage of the Kia was a relay, you wouldn't have a polarity problem. If the final stage is a NPN or a PNP transistor, which is polarity sensitive, you'll only get the right operation when it's wired in the right direction. So with a simple experiment or by reading the manual, you should be able to find that out pretty fast. I'm guessing the owner's manual, Paul, is going to tell you what voltage and what polarity comes out of the straight key function of that particular rig. And so once you're in the CW mode and you're using that keyer into that keyer plug, it sounds to me like it's going to fly. WS2N, K2RIW, back to you, Paul. And after that's all making sense, go on with the space report if you have one. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, thanks, Rich. Yeah, we'll do that. You read the instructions, and I'm paraphrasing, but basically, if you don't wire it up right, you can cause damage to the rig and all. You know, they scare the wits out of you when you read this stuff. So, I just wanted to double check. I thought, though, I didn't see why that would be a problem, but I figured I'd better check. And very good. As far as the space portion part of the night, I just reviewed the Curiosity mission, make sure that's going okay. It was supposed to have a course correction 15 days after the launch. There's six scheduled course corrections from here to Mars, which is next August, and they're already canceling the first one because it's right on target. So they're going to wait a while. They purposely, let me drop it. They purposely shoot for Mars, but they plan on missing it by about 30,000 miles. The idea is that, you know, there's a booster, this Centaur booster that really follows the same trajectory all the way to Mars. They want to make sure that thing doesn't accidentally hit Mars. You know, it doesn't go through the sterile process. One thing they worry about is bringing bacteria or any kind of contaminants from Earth to Mars. And the Centaur rocket doesn't go through the rigorous cleaning that the Curiosity rover does. So they want to make sure that doesn't hit Mars. And then, you know, all looks well. You know, so I think we'll be waiting for that.
wanted to bring that up. And then also Voyager, that was in the news recently. The Voyager was the ones that were launched back in 77, and that is well out, almost to the heliopause from dropping. They were wondering when it would get actually into stellar space, you know, outside of the solar system, even though it's well past Pluto, about three times the distance of Pluto. They figured out that about 5 years from now, it should do that. And the same for Voyager 1 and, you know, Voyager 2. And it's a 12.5-hour transmission, just one direction to the spacecraft, and another 12.5 hours back for a response of the speed of light. So that gives you an idea of where these two things are. And the recent change that they did to the spacecraft was lowering the internal heating, trying to save on that. You know, they have heaters on it. There is a RTG, a radioisotope thermocouple generator on board that thing too, and that's why this thing is going 33 years later. Voyager will probably last now, they think, at least another 10 years because of that adjustment they just made about a couple of weeks ago. So that's pretty much it, Vic. Not much really new. No new mission planned, no big mission to be launched that I could see in the near future. But there are plenty that are out there that are, you know, we're waiting for results. Further results from Messenger going around Mercury, further results from the Rosetta mission going to gigantic asteroid that was by the European Space Agency. And of course, Curiosity, now New Horizons. So there's a lot of missions that are still out there. Cassini, of course, still sending back very good results. But New Horizons, probably around the orbit of Uranus now. And roughly halfway there, like you said, Dick. Back to you. WS2N.
Glad to hear all that, Paul. The solar wind is the particles being boiled off by the sun. Those particles come flying out of the sun at around a million miles an hour. And as those particles hit the Earth's atmosphere, it's one of the causative agents of the aurora that we see when there's a solar storm that gives you an increased intensity of the solar wind. It's the major causative agent of the particles going into the Van Allen belt, and the ones that hit the North Pole and the South Pole, we see them as a aurora, aurora borealis and australis. The solar wind, like everything else, following the inverse square law, as it goes further and further out, starts slowing down due to gravity from the sun and the solar system. And at something like three times the distance of Pluto, the solar wind essentially comes to a stop. And now what particles you find out there are the galactic particles as opposed to the solar particles. And that transition between the two, I think, is one of the explanations for the so-called heliopause. Is that approximately a good guess on my part, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's about right. In fact, they talk about the heliopause all the time. Basically, it's interstellar gas that's slowing the solar wind down. So, and they detected that for quite a while. They noticed that, you know, there's a detector on board. They could tell what direction it's coming from. And they noticed a couple of years ago the angle was starting to change. So that meant some of it was bouncing off the heliosphere and then starting to go in other directions. So they knew it was coming to a stop, and it's going to come to a complete stop. And they think now, about 5 years from now, it'll be into really into interstellar, well, what would you call it, beyond the solar system, you know, that space area from here until I think another 30,000 years before it gets to another star system.
So, from my point of view, one definition of where does our solar system end, it's where you can't really measure anything from the solar system anymore. The solar wind is probably the thing that goes out there the furthest. And we're not talking about gravity effects now. We're just talking about real particles. So the solar wind changes in direction and essentially comes to a stop, is the anticipation, at three times the distance of Pluto. Pluto is something like 39 astronomical units, so I guess we're talking about 110 or so astronomical units is where the solar system, astronomical units is the distance between Earth and the Sun. So roughly 110 of those distances is a good guess as to where the solar wind goes and stops, and now you've got the intergalactic wind. Now you're in the galaxy, you're out of the solar system. Many of the Star Trek programs had some kind of a wall-like effect that they went through when they left the solar system. And I'm relatively sure there is no real wall out there, just as the solar wind gets weaker and weaker and stops moving. And maybe those particles turn around and start coming back. And so Paul was also telling us they don't slow down only because of the gravity of the solar system, but the solar wind is hitting the other particles that are in between the planets. But when it comes to the, what was I going to say? I had another point along these lines. Let me drop
that.
Go ahead, Paul.
That you were saying where the solar system officially ends. They would, a lot of astronomers think it's really the Oort cloud. That's way out there. That's almost halfway between here and the next star. So, you know, that's roughly 2 light years away.
Okay. Beyond our solar system, so-called 9 planets, you've got something called Kepler, the Kuiper Belt, and the Oort cloud. Give me a very rough guess, Paul. How many astronomical units is the Kuiper Belt? How many astronomical units is the Oort cloud, if you happen to know? Over to you, Paul.
Well, I really think Pluto is part of the Kuiper Belt, so you can, you know, I would consider that the beginning, so that's 39 AU. That goes on, you know, another 10 AU, I guess. You know, it's just trillions of little particles continually going around, but on the ecliptic plane, similar to all the planets. Now the Oort cloud, that's different. If you were to make a big sphere around the sun, you know, it's not an ecliptic plane. It's a sphere of all these particles. That goes all the way out to half the distance between here and Alpha Centauri. So that's, Alpha Centauri is about 4 light years, so you figure 2 light years out. A little less than that, I think. Now, the reason for that is when all the gas and everything started, everything coalesced, when things started moving in a circle, you wound up with this type of thing. But a lot of gas wasn't caught up by that. And that's what the Oort cloud is, and that's why you have a sphere. That's really what's left over. Back to each other.
That's good to know, that the Oort cloud is a spherical surface around our particular solar system, and the Kuiper Belt is in the galactic plane, in the ecliptic plane, the plane of all the planets. So it's sort of Kuiper Belt is sort of a ring around our solar system, and the Oort cloud is a spherical surface around our solar system. That's a new one on me, Paul. I'm glad that you brought it to my attention. I've never heard that one before. I should have. And half the distance to Alpha Centauri would make it around 2 light years away. That's really getting out there. And I think the furthest object that mankind has ever sent into space is the Voyager, which is now, what, 2.5 times the distance to Pluto, I guess that makes it around, what, 85 astronomical units? Is that a rough guess as to how far each of the Voyager craft are out there, Paul? Go ahead.
No, it's over three times the distance, so you're into the 120s now, I think, and maybe more. 120 or more AU. You're way out there.
HBR.
What was it? Pioneer 10 and 11. They were the ones that were furthest out, and because these things are going faster than those two were, these things are traveling 40,000 miles an hour away from Earth. So they're really hauling, which is kind of weird because look at the New Horizons spacecraft. Distance, the speed away from Earth is only about 8,000 miles, I think they said now. 70-some-odd thousand relative to the Sun, but which makes sense, because the Earth is about 60-65,000 miles per hour around the Sun, and this thing is going in front of the Earth as we go along. So speed was everything for Voyager 1 and 2. We drop it. Voyager 1, I think, is on the ecliptic plane, and the other one is going like 30 degrees off the ecliptic plane. So, one is looking kind of down on us, you know, from the north, the northern respect, and the other one is, you know, continuing along on the ecliptic plane. But both of them got Pioneer speed out by a mile.
N2HVR recognized, and I'm going to turn it over to you in a minute, Nick. Since you told us earlier, Paul, that at the speed of light, communication with Voyager is 12 and a half hours at 186,000 miles per second. That's at 640 million miles an hour. It takes 12 and a half hours for the signal to go one way to Voyager and another 12 hours to come back. When I get a chance, that allows me to do a much better calculation as to how many astronomical units. One astronomical unit, 93 million miles between us and the Sun, I think is something like 8.5 minutes at the speed of light. So we can figure that all out. The raw data is there. Nicholas, I think it is, N2HVR, what would you like to add to all this? K2RIW in the second half. Okay, Mr. OJO, give me your full call letters again and your name. I should know you. K2RIW, go right ahead.
That's Kilo Charlie 2, Oscar Juliet Oscar Howard, and the comment relates to the interference.
Go right ahead and tell us about that 28 megacycle interference, Howard.
Right after the discussion, I went upstairs to the shack, turned on my HF receiver, tuned to 28320, and sure enough, there is that whistle between 28.317 and 28.320. It seemed familiar. So I moved about 30 feet away to another room, and I turned off my Netgear hub. Actually, it's a switch, a Netgear switch. That's for 10, 100 megabits per second, and the whistle went away. So I said, gee, maybe not. I turned the Netgear guy back on, and guess what? The whistle came back, and I repeated it again. So I think it may have nothing to do with the power plant. Back to you.
Bravo 1, Oscar with the Gulf.
I confirm that, Dick. I just did it.
Wow. So in other words, a lot of these people running Netgear are hearing a 28.320, 317 to 320 signal. In other words, there's an exact oscillator in the so-called Netgear. John, give me a couple of words on Netgear. I'm very light on computer hardware. What is Netgear? Is this some kind of a interface by which a person gets a web access? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, it is, Dick. If my Verizon router coming in on the Fios line, I turned it off, and sure enough, it's gone. Dead positive, that's it.
Wow. Are every one of them on an exact crystal oscillator on exactly 28117 to 2820, 28317 to 28320? Or are there individual oscillators on these Verizon interface hardware? Or is there something about the fiber itself that supplies the phase lock signal, so to speak? What's your guess on this one, John? Over to you, John.
Mr. KC2LJO again. It's not an exact oscillator because I don't recall how many kilohertz it's apart, but you see basically harmonics above that. So whatever's causing it is probably a fair distance below it. Back to net.
That's very good to know. Let's see what John's thinking on this is. Tell us anything you know about Netgear, John. And do you think there are individual oscillators at individual houses? I mean, lots of people have got Verizon interface for their television, telephone, internet connection, whatever. So maybe what Dave was really measuring is these zillions of homes that have all got Verizon interconnects. And an interesting question is, are the individual Netgear, are they above the FCC requirements for interference? KC2WGB and anyone else after that? K2RIW in the TechNet?
Well, Dick, this router plugs into my network card in the computer. And what this does, it allows me to hook directly to it through the RJ45s up to five computers. But it also has an RF transmitter at 2.4 gig. Which allows me to have the internet cards, which have a little antenna that plug into the either ACA ports or or whatever you have. Also, there's some Linksys cards that you can plug in with little antennas. So that's 2.4 gig. Now, what's happening, I don't know. So I don't know where the noise is coming from. It's definitely coming from that box.
If Dave is still on frequency, AK1NS, Dave, I wonder if you're hearing this, and when it comes to your particular search, when you now start driving around and putting dots on the map and signal strengths, if it's really coming from the Verizon Netgear, and there's also another red herring there, a lot of acoustic noise coming out of that transformer from that power station, but still, you're now going to get a very complicated complicated map of signal strengths versus location. If you've got these zillions of netware pieces of hardware on people with Verizon interconnects on all of those individual houses. So your life's going to get much more complicated, possibly, Dave, if you're there. AK1NS, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Dave. Okay, anybody who runs into Dave during the week, try to bring this newest piece of information to his attention. Because other than that, he's going to get awfully confused where he drives around. Well, he's either going to think it's a remote a reading meter, a so-called demand meter, a LOCO, a LIFO demand meter, and or Verizon interconnect information. In fact, since I've had the Verizon system hooked up in my house about a year ago, I do hear a bunch of unusual frequencies. I haven't been smart enough to tune to 28 megs. I'm now going to go look when I get a chance to 28 megs and see what's there. And so I probably have it too. I maybe do some driving around my neighborhood. There's another whole set of investigations we've got to do. Have I skipped anyone with the normal sign-in ham radio type questions?
Excuse me, Dick. This is KC2OJO again.
10-2-8-DG.
It has nothing to do with Verizon. My Verizon equipment was on. I did not shut that off. I have, as John said, out of the Verizon router, you have a basically Ethernet signal. That